And then, so your thought of your question about like, is it given or taken? I think that some people can have crazy exceptions where it's given for a solitary moment, but no, I think that it's taken.
David Gao has been busy. As an actor with the chops for Shakespeare, he is just as at home with the contemporary complexity of Peter and the Starcatcher and morphs just as elegantly to even newer works, including not one, not two, not three, but four world or regional premieres on his resume. David's film and TV work have landed him on CBS, True TV, and a plethora of film festivals, and we were incredibly lucky to have him play the goofy and sometimes cringy try-hard Jason in our short film screen test. Not only is David an incredible actor, but he's a serious gem of a human being, and I'm so happy he's here today on the podcast. Welcome to The Break Breakdown, David.
Ugh, what a mean introduction. I hated that.
I just wanted to like give you something to really put you in your place.
Yeah, it worked. Thank you so much.
So before we like really dive into this, I feel there's no way I could start talking to anyone on the planet Earth right now without just touching base and seeing how you're doing during this very awful, weird, confusing time of the coronavirus. So how are you? How's it been going?
Yeah, I'm good today. Today's good. I'm currently home with my family in Houston, and honestly, because I knew I was doing this and I got to talk about acting and art in some way, I've been looking forward to it all day, which has kind of put me in a good mood. So this has been a gift for me. I'm excited.
Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so happy you're here. And I love that you just said I'm okay today because I saw a friend of mine through many, many years ago of auditioning and all of that stuff, recently lost someone important to her. And she had just put up on social somewhere, you know, when someone's grieving, it's best just to ask how they are today, as opposed to how are you? Because I don't, how am I? I'm awful. I'm grieving someone that I love, you know? And I feel like we're all in a grief state in some way or another, whether or not we've lost people, we are grieving a world that, you know, won't be the same. So I appreciate you saying today, like, I'm okay today.
Yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah, that's sort of been my go-to, because to say like, oh my gosh, I'm fantastic, just seems so put on and false. So yeah, today seems to be much more realistic.
I like that. I'm gonna use that from now on. Thanks. Okay, so you are so interesting to me. You. For many reasons, but one is that you have this picture of, I feel like you have this picture of the United States of America that I do not have, which is because you grew up in Texas, in Houston, where you are now. You went to California very briefly for school, and then you transferred to school in North Carolina, and now you live in New York City. And Texas and North Carolina are very different than New York City, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
No, you're right, for sure.
Okay. Okay. And so in this like crazy time too, I want to know from someone who knows, who would be you, what do Northerners get wrong about the South and what do Southerners get wrong about the North?
Okay, so there's sort of the lighthearted answer to this and then the real talk answer to this. So
I'll give you both.
So the lighthearted one is when I first left Texas, people would ask me, oh, are there tumbleweeds rolling down the road? And do you ride a horse to school? Which I loved. I'd be like, yeah, you know, patches take me to school. And then on the weekend, I ride butterscotch out. I would just lie to everyone and say that I had a bunch of horses. And then Southerners, like when I come back from New York, people in Texas love to do this New York accent of like, oh, I'm from New York. And I'm like, I don't think I've actually ever met someone in Manhattan that talks like this.
Oh my gosh.
So that's sort of the caricature misconception. I'd say a lot of it is, and thankfully when you say like this moving around gave me a different perspective of the country, which ended up being really helpful because I used to think that if you weren't really bubbly and outgoing and friendly, that meant you weren't nice or kind. And I remember when I met my older brother's now wife for the first time, she had been all over the world, or not the world, the country. And I'd really only been in Texas. And so when I met her, I was kind of like, he says she's so great, but she didn't seem nice to me. And that was just because I believe that slapping a smile on your face and being really enthusiastic and laughing and asking lots of questions about a person defined if you were nice. And so that was something that I learned when I left the South, basically, that actually doesn't mean that you're nice. And now it's kind of weird when I come back here and I see people doing it. I'm like, well, I guess I'm flattered you're trying so hard, but also I can see exactly what you're doing. And you could, you know, you don't have to be screaming. You don't have to smile so much. We can just talk and have a normal conversation.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that actually is something that I probably would, if I had never left Texas, I would still think that that's what defined a kind person. So,
you know, I don't even know. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I don't know if it's a regional thing or if it's I don't know, something else in the water in certain places. But I think that I have probably had the same feeling as, you know, sometimes when I meet people and I shake their hand, I feel like I'm going to rip their hand off and hurt them. I'm trying so hard to be like, I see you. I love you.
Yeah.
I'm just getting in their face. And I think for me, that probably comes from a fear of, I don't know. I got to go to therapy and figure that one out. I don't know what it comes from, but I just want people to feel liked and loved by me. But I agree with you. There's something else that's subtler that can be sometimes even kinder because it's more present.
Totally. And actually what you're describing, we'll get to the character that I played in the movie, but it just reminds me of him because his demeanor is very different than mine, and sort of his need to please. But it's sort of an interesting thing to watch in society of two people can make the worst first impression on each other purely just off of if they feel they need to, like how much effort they need to put into making an impression, you know?
Right. Well, and I mean, I'm like down the social media is the devil rabbit hole right now. Mm-hmm. Because I made screen test and I also just watched The Social Dilemma. Have you seen that yet?
I watched, this is like a film, right? I think I watched the trailer mm-hmm. for it, but I haven't watched the whole thing yet.
Yeah, it's a documentary.
Yes.
And I think I'm going to do an episode about it because it's so very much links to some things I've been thinking about, A, mental health and creativity, and B, like everything behind screen test and why I wanted to write that particular story.
Yeah. I almost texted you when I watched it. It's exactly, it's like in the exact same world that your film is in.
Yeah. Which is this flat space of impressions. And I know you were using impression in another way and like a, I'm meeting you. How are you? Nice to meet you in real life impression. But this whole idea of like it flat, like social media kind of flattens everything. So we have a strategy or a formula or rubric for how we can engage in that space. And then we get into these real spaces and the nuance is gone and the mystery is gone. And I mean, I feel like I've been doing this like people pleasing thing all my life, and all my life I have not had social media. I grew up without it. So I'm not saying social media makes you be a people pleaser, but I do think it complicates the way that we interact with each other because there's always this third thing, which is this grammable? You know, am I I don't know, like, am I filtering this conversation through the lens of that flat screen that I'm attached to 75% of the day? I mean, it's a bigger conversation and I got to think through it a little bit more, but
that is sort of similar to the Southern, bubbliness that we were talking about of in Instagram, you're picking out the highlights of your life and
right,
you're in
right.
the South and you're being really friendly and on. Well, you're not always like that. Human beings are not, but we have to act like we are when we're meeting people. So right. we're the same.
Oh my God. All right. I got to do that episode. I'm not going to do it right now, but I'm going to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you definitely should.
Okay. You are honestly, this cast, I honestly can't, I don't know why we got so lucky with you guys, but we really did. And I remember watching your reel and with Craig and we were like, oh my God, you just kept jumping back and forth between so many different, not like in the reel was different cuts of things you've done. Not like you were jumping back and forth as a character, but like uh-huh. there were so many different levels that you brought and so many, just so many like pointedly funny or pointedly sad or exciting or subtle things that you did. Like there was just such a broad spectrum. And I was like, oh my God, I get to say that I knew him when. That's amazing, first of all. And I still feel that. And secondly, you could just tell how much you love the craft of acting. And maybe I'm wrong and you hate it, but do you love acting? And also, if you do, then what was the moment that made you fall in love with it?
I'm a complete acting junkie. I'm obsessed with it. So yes, I know exactly when I fell in love with it. So, okay. There was a production of a professional production of Winnie the Pooh that was happening somewhere in Houston.
I love you so much. I cannot overstate that right at this moment. Okay. Continue.
And, I don't know if I'd ever seen a play at this point. And two grades above me, there was a girl named Audie Thornton who was sort of a child star. She'd done a bunch of movies at this point and she was playing Rue in the production. And the director of like the high school theater that we both went to was also directing the show on the side. And so since this girl Audie, I would love if somehow Audie stumbled upon this podcast and was listening to this. She's on like This Is Us. She's like a TV star now.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. Hi, Audie. The director, said, well, we need like a kid to play Christopher Robin. Cause all the adults except for Rue or like all the, animals in this play of Winnie the Pooh were going to be adults. And she's like, we want the kid to be Christopher Robin. So she said to the teachers, like, just get a bunch of really blonde kids to come in and read for this. So I remember someone coming in and just kind of looking around the classroom and like pulling out the, you know, really blonde boys and was like, do you want to read for this? And so we did. And it was so like level one of when I'm reading it, I'm reading the stage directions too, because I'd never seen a script, whatever. but
wait, how old were you?
I was six.
Okay.
And plucked from obscurity at 6 years old. And I somehow got the part and it was on at that point. I remember being, I could not get enough. I soaked up every second of the rehearsal. I would go to these rehearsals when I wasn't called. And again, I'm six, all of them are adults and like taking smoke breaks and I'm just sitting there. And I remember we didn't have understudies. And so there were times when an actor couldn't be there and I knew every single line of the entire play. So I would just jump up and play Kanga. I couldn't get enough. And so I was hooked. I mean, I knew it and my mom knew it that I was hooked on acting from the very beginning. And then I did a few more plays as a kid. But it wasn't really what my family did. We were very, very sports oriented and very much Friday Night Lights football. And so I had a lot of pressure to do sports, and I kind of got made fun of for acting. And so I stopped doing it for a while, and then for a long time, actually. And then I, right before college, before I went to Pepperdine in the summer, I was like, you know what? I'm going off to college. I'm never going to get a chance to do it. I'm like hanging out in Houston for the summer before I go to college. Why don't I do some shows? And so I did. And then it was over. Then I, you know, was the 6-year-old acting junkie again. And I've just been obsessed with it ever since.
You couldn't unknow it, right?
Yes. It's like I fought it and ran away from it for, you know, 12 years, but it was there the whole time. I was obsessed. Well,
it's your hero's journey. You know, yeah. you've got to not answer the call before you answer the call.
Yeah, totally.
So you went to Pepperdine before North Carolina. So were you going to school for acting at Pepperdine, or had you chosen a different?
Yeah, So I was going to go for sports psychology, which I actually still think I would love doing. But the week before, I did these shows in the summer, and then the week before school, I had this massive epiphany of I want to do this. And so I emailed, this is nuts. I emailed the head of the theater department on a Friday when school started on Monday, being like, can I audition for you? Not knowing that, you know, college auditions happen in like November, 9 months before school starts.
Right. And
she's like, okay. I mean, I have free time in a couple hours, come to this room. And so then I was sprinting around. I mean, I had gotten to campus like the day before. I was sprinting around campus asking people where the library was so I could find a play to memorize a monologue. Like, it was just the most last second audition. I showed up wearing basketball shorts and like a baggy t-shirt. I think I had a headshot. I'm honest. I definitely didn't have a resume.
This is just fascinating, because you're saying that like the Friday before the Monday that classes started, you were at a brand new college, you're 18 years old, and you're like, you know what? Nah, psychology.
I know. I mean, it was, I printed off this monologue. I like copied and pasted it. No. This is such a tangent from screen test, but whatever. I'll go quick. So I found
this play. This is important.
I found this play in the library, and I found a monologue, and then I went to a computer and on a Word document typed out the monologue, printed it, and then I went into the library bathroom, and whenever someone wasn't in the bathroom, I would just practice it over and over again, and then someone would come in and I'd go quiet. And then so I had like 2 minutes or 2 hours to do all of this. And then I remember as I was going to the audition, I called my old a director I had, and I was like, okay, so what's the protocol with this audition? Do I hand them the monologue when I audition so they can watch it and make sure I get all the words? And they were like, absolutely not. So I knew nothing. And so then I got in, and I called my family, and I was like, surprise, I'm doing this instead. And then on Monday started, and
my God. I mean, like, this story is blowing my mind. First of all, I see the movie, like I see you sitting there on a toilet, like lifting your feet up, acting like you're not in there or something.
Yeah, actually.
In the monologue. This is amazing. So then you're at Pepperdine for a couple years and you're like, you know what? I didn't like what was the transition to go to North Carolina?
Yeah. So I loved Pepperdine, and it was kind of a safe transition from the world I was in Houston to then, it was just a very similar culture to the upbringing I had, and I loved acting, but it was a good program, and I loved the school and I loved the people, but it's a liberal arts education. So, it was, you know, two acting classes a week, which at this point, again, when the siren was just going off of this is all I want to do. And I think I also had a little bit of, the clock is ticking of like, I'm a little late to this, and some people have been doing it, you know, since they were six, like I did, but they did it then their whole life. They never left it. So I kind of felt like if I do want to pursue this and I want to be the best actor I can, I need to like do some serious catch up. And while I loved Pepperdine, I think that meant I needed to go to a conservatory.
This is blowing my mind because at this point that they're that you and I are recording this, LaWanda's episode hasn't aired yet. Uh-huh. But we had a very similar, not similar in content, but a similar conversation about feeling behind and feeling like you didn't have the same training everyone else did growing up. And I look at you two individuals as actors and I'm like, they didn't, you know, you didn't need that. Like, you know, not to discount all the work that it takes to be an actor. You both have worked really hard and you both are incredible crafts people when it comes to that. But just so interesting too that, you know, in my little world too, I never felt like I had the right training or enough training and I always still feel behind. So when you went to the conservatory and you were just, you know, in the studio day in and day out, did you get through that experience feeling like, all right, I've caught up?
Yeah.
Or is that a feeling?
I think I did. So there were pros and cons, I think, for being kind of a late bloomer with this. I didn't grow up singing and dancing my whole life. So that just, I won't ever be competitive in because I don't have the hours for that. But it, so much of acting is just being a human. And so I think because I didn't grow up acting, I avoided a lot of really bad habits of schmacting and fakeness on stage. So that was a benefit going to the conservatory, pretty green. And then also it was nice because most of the people that were in my class that got there were like, oh my gosh, first time out of the college, let's go. And I just left Pepperdine, which is in Malibu and in paradise on the beach. And I was in a fraternity and I kind of felt like I've already done the college fun thing. I just want to be here to work.
Right.
So I buckled down and and that school was like military school for acting. It was crazy. You wear all black every single day and you have acting classes from 8 or 9 a.m. until 11 p.m. and then rehearsals all day Saturday. I mean, and it's just acting. They kick your ass in acting.
Right.
Which I was in heaven, which it was nice. Like immediately when I got there and I saw the schedule and I was doing it and I realized I loved it. It was nice. I was like, okay, I made the right choice. Cause I left, you know, a lot of people I loved at Pepperdine and it was beautiful there, but I'm so glad I went there. And yeah, to answer your question, like after the 4 years, thankfully I don't feel like I'm raw and I'm still playing catch up and learning because that school is rigorous and it was the boot camp that I wanted.
Right. It sounds like in some ways that, you know, because football, my dad is a retired football coach. My brother was an all-star football player in high school. So when I hear boot camp, I think of like three-a-days at the end of the summer, uh-huh. and like football boot camp. So it sounds like in some ways you did take that family kind of tradition over like discipline and like the discipline that comes with football. And you're like, I'm going to take these principles and values and I'm going to apply it over here as an actor.
That's actually such a good way to put it that I haven't thought of because my family, I mean, from my youngest brother. Okay. So very quickly, my dad was the quarterback at my high school and then played college football and wore number 10. My older brother was the quarterback in high school. 10 younger brother quarterback at high school wore number 10 played college football and then the youngest brother quarterback number 10 and is currently playing college football. So we had like a dynasty at this school. And so I remember like my youngest brother at age 6, my dad was in the front yard with him with traffic cones and they were doing suicides and drills. I mean, we just were bred from the beginning to do this. And so I think it did instill in me like a crazy competitive work ethic, but I couldn't like sink my teeth into it because I just didn't have the spirit for it or the body. I mean, they're all just like built like trucks. They're like 6'4". And so, yeah, I think it was helpful that I finally found the thing I wanted to apply that mentality to in life that I had sort of been searching for as a kid.
I think that it's a tricky thing as an artist because you have to be so disciplined, but you also have to be so free, you know? Uh-huh. And that, you know, I who was I talking with? I think Sarah in the first interview episode I did, we were talking about how it's all about, you know, preparation and then allowing yourself to let go in the moment. And I have never played football, but I imagine with sports, that's the same thing. You weight train, you run the drill, you do the thing. And then, but the moment that you are playing, the moment that you are acting, the moment that you're, you know, on set and the director says action, it's its own thing. It's its own beast. So I didn't tell you I was going to ask this, but I'm just wondering, like, how much for your acting process, how much for you is it about letting go, and how much of it is about the plan?
I mean, that I think will, until the day I die, be sort of a juggle. I am very much, I love doing my homework, and I feel like a fraud if I don't. So to put in comparison, so Kennedy, who I is in the film, we did a play right before screen test. And to me, I mean, he might say otherwise, he's the opposite. He gets a script, he reads it, and he's like, got it. And boom, the character's there. And he just has really, really good impulses. And it's not to say he doesn't work hard, but there's not a huge before and after for him from the table read to the end product, because he's just really good and his instincts are spot on. I don't like even opening my mouth to say a line until I've done just a nauseating amount of work. Because if I don't have a huge reason for why I'm saying each word, then alarms go off in my brain of, this is David pretending, or this is David doing the idea of it. So, and maybe that's all just psychological. Maybe people that have worked with me would say, no, you were pretty much the same before and after, but it, at least in my head and my experience, I feel very much like I'm a slow burner and there's a stark difference between the beginning and the end.
So in college, I had an acting teacher who said, it doesn't matter what you're feeling. It matters what the audience is feeling. And mm-hmm. she was very much like technical. And I got that and I understood it. And I thought she was correct, but I hated it because I was like, but I want to participate. I want to feel things. And I do think that there's a value in creating a process for yourself as an actor or artist or teacher or doctor. Well, maybe doctors should be pretty rigorous and don't really stray.
Doctors shouldn't just be following random impulses in the moment.
Yeah. Don't do that if you're a doctor. But if you're anything else, less surgical, I think there is something to be said for creating your own process that gets your head in the space it needs to be to do the thing. So maybe I'm playing Ophelia and I don't need to feel like I want to die. I don't need to feel that, but I need to do something as the actor to get into that space, to say the words, to bring the audience on a journey. So whether or not your outer depiction of the character is, you know, black and white to the outside world doesn't really matter if it is to you as the actor.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I also agree with your teacher, and I'm still kind of learning this because I think actors love basking in their emotions on stage and like kneeling.
Oh yes.
Right. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're doing a good job or the audience is feeling like that's a little self-indulgent. However, right. I need to at least create a world where I am believing that the character in the story is my reality so that I don't think, oh, I'm just David wearing someone else's clothes on stage, because that's scary.
Right. Or I'm David and how am I doing?
Yeah, am I doing okay? Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about Jason, your character in Screen Test. I love Jason. Tell me a little bit about him.
Okay, so this has been a while, so if I get some facts about him wrong, please jump in. But he is in his 20s, and he's from Minnesota, and he is a former collegiate cheerleader turned fitness instructor. I would say the things that are similar to Jason and I are so I was a personal trainer for 2 years in New York. So besides that, I thought the script was hilarious. That was sort of an interesting draw that I had to the script when I first read it. But I just sort of was a personal trainer as a means of just a survival job so I could act. So I didn't really delve into like the whole world of it. I never really posted about training. I liked it, but I just kind of did it to make money. And so Jason's very much also in the world of that, all of them are, of social media with personal training and fitness journeys and stuff like that. He also has a huge need to please, I think, which I also have. I think we express it differently, but he's, I think the character description first said, like, he's sitting so straight up with good posture and so forward in his chair that he's almost falling over. Jason's very much like a foot forward kind of person through life.
Yeah, he's like... He's like Courtney Romano, 22 years old, fresh off the Bieber bus in New York City. I am your friend. I am here. I will do a good job.
Is this the Courtney that in an audition when she was complimented about her shoes, she said, I like your shoes? Because that was my favorite story you've said on this podcast yet.
Sarah just DM'd me. I felt that. If people are listening to this before you listen to the episode, it's the episode with Kennedy, and I tell a really, really, really embarrassing audition story, and it's probably why they never cast me in the Addams Family on Broadway, and probably like my voice wasn't good enough, but I like to romanticize the fact that had I not been awkward, they would have been like, yes, you're the one.
By the way, very quickly, yes. I did that in an audition as well, where one time they asked me, like, do you have any tumbling experience? And again, I did this same thing that Jason does or that you did in this room where I'm trying to work the room. So when they asked me that, I was like, when they're like, do you have any tumbling experience? I was like, well, not intentionally. And it just went silent. It was horrible. God. And I was like, be relatable. Like, I trip and fall down. It was horrible.
Be relatable. Oh my God. Why? Why are we so awkward in those rooms? I would never. Oh God, that's so funny. I appreciate you sharing that. So people don't think I'm the only weird one. We're all very strange. Yeah. That is really funny. Yeah, Jason, the whole line about getting to the studio 45 minutes early because the trains aren't really running that early in the morning, that was literally taken from my life. I would wake up at 4:15 and I knew I had to leave my apartment by whatever specific time it was because it was a 5-minute walk to the subway, and I'd walk to the subway and I would time it so that I would be 2 minutes early, because at like 4:30 in the morning, that's like, you can't be more than 2 minutes early. And then I would get down to Tribeca like way like 5:15, and my class was at 6 a.m. I don't know.
Those hours just sound horrible.
They were awful. And it was at the time in my life where there were, I remember another trainer who was in my kind of training level, meaning like we started at the same time and we kind of went through training at the same time. She was like, we were talking about it one day. She's like, oh yeah, I mean, I live in Astoria. There's no way I can teach 6 a.m. classes. So I just told them I couldn't teach 6 a.m. classes. And it never dawned on me to say, I live in Astoria. I cannot teach 6 a.m. classes, because I was just like, everything was predicated on the notion in my 20s that if I don't show up for every single thing that people want out of me, I will not be able to pay my rent. I will not, you know, get anywhere. I won't, like, whatever the steps I needed to achieve, I wouldn't be able to achieve them if I didn't do everything everyone asked of me. So
right.
Like right now I'm starting to get really hot. Like I'm starting to stress out. I think I just raised my blood pressure even thinking about it, because it's taken me years and I'm not, and I have not mastered it yet, but I am really trying to work on disappointing people.
Yeah.
Like, not intentionally, but just like because of boundaries. And Jason does not have any boundaries.
No, not at all.
Not at all. So you talked a little bit about this, but how did you prepare for this particular role?
Okay. So first of all, when people ask, how do you prepare differently for drama or comedy? My answer is I prepare the exact same, but with comedy, I have to constantly do a check-in reminder with myself of stick to the work you've done and don't try to be funny. Don't do like the cop out of you see the writing on the page and it's funny, so I'm going to say it this way because that's a joke. Because whenever I'm trying to be funny, I'm not funny. But if I create a really ridiculous character and then I come in and I tell the truth, then I think it can be effective. I watched this interview with Catherine O'Hara, who I think obviously masterful at doing this with ridiculous characters. And she's amazing at, she will go home and do, she will create an absurd character that's hilarious. And she's probably aware it's hilarious. But then when she comes in to do the shoot, she's not trying to be funny. She's just telling the truth and saying the lines and living in this identity that she's created. And so there was some interview that she did where she was talking about her need to remain in this Moira Rose character that she's created for Schitt's Creek. Which is tricky because she has an accent that's inexplicable and fictitious. So she, on set, if she felt like she was losing her accent, Eugene Levy would say, Moira, what's your favorite movie? And she would say, The Aviator. And that would get her back into the character she had created. She does a lot of mockumentaries, but for Screen Test, which is mockumentary style, I think it's such an easy trap of if we are playing the comedy, then at best it's cute, but then everyone can tell what we're doing. But if we actually create characters, which you've given us as like just their circumstances and what they say are ridiculous. If we create a ridiculous character and then leave it at home, which kind of goes to your idea of like what we were talking about earlier of homework and living in the moment. And do you just tell the truth? Then I think it's really funny, but I think it's a trickier trap to fall into with comedy than drama. But that's why when we first met at Starbucks, I was the dork that had like a list of questions for you about Jason. Cause I was like, I need to the temptation to just make Jason a caricature is so tempting. So we have to really, I need to like find out why he's talking about his uncle and his romantic life and all of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, remember meeting in Starbucks?
I know. And Elle was there.
And Elle was there. And she's like a whole new human being now. But no, like that's like you took out your notebook and I was like, oh, my people. Like this is what I live for. I love it. Let's get into it. But I totally agree. It's like if you are supposed to be drunk in a scene, you can't play drunk. You have to play trying to be sober.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like, because if you play drunk, you look like someone who's playing drunk. And if you play like you're trying to be sober, we assume you're drunk, you know? So, I think comedy is really tricky. And you know, Screen Test really is a character study. You know, someone called it a character study to me. One of my friends who saw the trailer, I think, was like, oh, this looks like a character study. It's so cool. And it really is in a lot of ways. And it's a character study. It's a lot of questions about social media and specifically Instagram and influence and advertisements and who we are in the midst of all of that. And I think sometimes also when something is so contemporary like that, it's also really easy to get tripped up in whatever is of the moment in that, you know what I mean? As opposed to telling the truth, but kind of putting that editorial hat on and being like, you know, I'm gonna spin it this way because currently this one thing is happening and we all think this is fun, you know, I'm not being super articulate about it, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. And also if your head is just focused on one specific moment or line, and then that's gonna trip you up. And then I will also say, I mean, this is not like actor craft in any way, but Jason is a very smiley person and a very positive person. And I'm a positive person, but manifests itself very differently. And I kind of have like a bored expression on my face naturally, which I've tried to work on as I've gotten older, but I knew he needed to smile a lot. And that takes a ton of energy for me, maybe because I'm an introvert or I just don't naturally smile all the time. And so about 20 minutes before we filmed the interview scenes, as Jason, I went off in the corner and ripped a 5-hour energy shot. So I would just be smiles for the take. So who knows, when I see it, I might have like bloodshot eyes and twitching, but I bet you I was smiling. So.
Oh honey, were you smiling? You have such a beautiful smile, and that makes me laugh so hard because it almost makes me feel sad for who I was at like 22, 23, because I did not take those 5-hour energy shots, and like they would have helped because it is a lot of energy to do.
Yeah, to be on and smiley like that for so long. Like it's if exhausting. I went around the world actually doing what Jason did, I would last 20 minutes and then I'd have to go to bed. It's too much.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, when Jason turns 32, it's a whole new film, you know?
Oh, we need a sequel of Jason where it turns a little bit dark. That's great.
I want a whole, look, whoever's out there, I want a whole series and or feature length film. So can we just manifest that? But there are so many ways to go with these characters that like they all get on the reality show and then 10 years later, what happened to them? Like, yeah. Where are they now? Kind of thing. Okay. I cannot wait for you to see it. Like you're working it. I've told this to basically every single one of you, and it's been true every single time I've said it. So I don't want to sound disingenuous at all, but you made me laugh all the time. Like, we edited it. I can't tell you how many times I've seen it. I can't tell you how many times I've looked at like one minute little, like half a second beat and been like, no, 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 no. Okay. It's that, you know, like that tedious work of post-production. You've made me laugh through the entire thing. I just feel so lucky that you were in the film. So this is obviously a podcast about screen tests, but I also have this burning question that I'm trying to figure out, which is, what is this industry? And I was always trying to figure that out before coronavirus, but now I'm super trying to figure it out. And, you know, it's an industry defined by your big break and getting your big break. And I feel more and more that a big break is an illusion, and it's not and it's not a real thing, that in the romantic sense that we've always made it. Like, I'm walking down the street and a casting director sees me, and then boom, I'm in the next film and I won the Academy Award. Like, you know, that kind of romantic version of it. So I'm wondering for you, how you would define a big break now, and do you think it's something that's given to us or taken by us?
Well, first of all, when I was little, you almost described exactly what I envisioned my big break being, of, except that it wasn't a casting director, it was just Steven Spielberg, and he was like, you want to be in my next ET movie. But that's literally like what I thought a big break was. I think it's sort of always shifted for me. I remember at school, it was like, okay, get signed out of Showcase by an agent or manager. And then it was go Equity and then go SAG. And so there's, the bar keeps shifting. One is, it's sort of stepping stones, but also because when you get one of them, it maybe feels like your big break for 30 minutes. But then when you sit with it, you realize it's actually not. I was doing a catering shift, just like a demoralizing catering shift, wearing a stupid outfit. Mm-hmm.
And it was, I hear that.
Yeah. And it was for the Met Gala. And I had like the most bougie table. It was the VIP
table. Wait, did you cater with RA?
Is that a catering company?
Restaurant Associates, yes.
No, but I did Olivia Chang, and the year I did it was their first year because the company that had it before like lost the gig. So maybe
that's amazing. Yeah, because okay. I did the Met all the time. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt, but okay. I just had that moment.
Okay.
Okay. So it's bougie.
It's bougie.
It's the Met.
Yeah, it's the VIP table. Everyone looks like an asshole, and I was like pouring wine for people, and I was pouring wine for Stephen Colbert and Hugh Jackman, and
right,
they are a little drunk at this point, and. Hugh Jackman's kind of in the dumps and Stephen Colbert is doing this drunken monologue. Just in case it's not drunk, tipsy, overserved, whatever. But he's giving this very enthusiastic speech, rallying cry to Hugh Jackman of like, I know it's hard when you don't get it, but you just got to push and push and push until you get there. And Hugh's kind of hanging his head, nodding. And I'm like, oh, poor Hugh. You know, he's only one of the biggest movie stars in the world. He's Wolverine, Oscar nominated, Tony winning actor, and as I'm like wearing this dorky outfit pouring him wine, and I was so pissed off, and then later I was like, I actually kind of love that at 51 he's this movie star with a crazy career and he still is looking forward to the next thing. And I was like, I don't, whatever career I have, I would like to have that mentality too. I always believe like the best is yet to come. And I think that if you get your big break and then you feel like, good, I got it, I'm done, then that's such a complacent, unfulfilling feeling to me that I don't think I want to experience. And then, so your question about like, is it given or taken? I think that some people can have crazy exceptions where it's given for a solitary moment, but no, I think that it's taken. I mean, even if you are given this huge platform, that what are you going to do with it after that? You have to keep moving. And I think my school did kind of prep us for that really well. I mean, I know you said this in other podcasts about, you know, if you can do something else besides acting, go do it. And there's going to be a lot of rejection. And I really sort of took that to heart. And I now think more, I was like, it's a numbers game. And I think more about, am I doing the right, enough auditions more than like, what am I booking? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm putting myself in a position to be successful and take something than just sort of sitting at home waiting for a phone call to ring that will not happen.
Yes. You know, when I was first auditioning in the city, I had a spreadsheet, and I forget if I talked about this before, maybe I wrote about it in my book or something. But I had a spreadsheet and it had every audition on it. And if I got a call back, if I didn't get a call back, like all the information about the audition, and I kept track, and I'd be like, okay, so I got to get through 25 auditions to get a show. Like, I have to get through 25 auditions and, like, you know, X number of callbacks, whatever it was. So when I would pass that 25th and I would get the show, you know, it wouldn't work out perfectly like that, but you know what I mean? Like, on average. And once I would get past that, I would start all over again and I'd be like, all right, one. Okay, two. And, you know, slowly, like you said, make it a numbers game. But it is something that I have forgotten and have had to remember as I've changed as an artist. So as an actor, I got that. I got that lesson right away, and I dug into it, and I made it part of my journey and my kind of philosophy. But now on the other side of the table, as it were, directing and writing, I have to remind myself, okay, this is the first film, and then I have to do the second film, and then the third, and whatever. And so these things will add up and create a body of work. But, you know, so it's just interesting that it is a numbers game. And I feel like as we change as artists or as we evolve in our artistry, we've got to remember that to a certain degree in the different areas that we find ourselves making work.
Oh, I think we're the same person because I have the exact same audition log spread. And I give myself a reward every 50 auditions. I give myself a little present.
What do you get?
Something tasty. I don't know. I it's always food. And
oh my
it's
God.
So dorky,
we
but
are.
Just between us. But I'll do it in food, but I make it like in the shape of it. So when I hit my 100th, it was like two donuts and then like something for the one to spell out the number 100.
I'm so obsessed dork. With you. It's like beyond. I love that so much. And you know what? It's also like, I love that because it's like, hey, I'm going to celebrate and it's going to be kind of like, I'm taking myself seriously, but I'm not totally. And then I'm going to move on and I'm going to do 101.
And then it's celebrating the work that I'm putting into it. Not so much the result and things that are not in my control, which is satisfying.
Absolutely. Yeah. What did you misunderstand about being an artist when you started out that you understand better now?
Okay, I thought when I first started acting and I heard artists talking about the importance of storytelling and how it can change people's lives, I kind of thought that was BS. And I was like, they're just saying that to pat themselves on the back and they're doing it. We're all doing it for the same reasons I'm doing it, which is we love it and it's what we want to be doing. And it's about the pleasure we get in acting and it's fun. It's performing. And then really diving in, I think I probably had that mentality until I got to a conservatory. And now I'm realizing not only do I not think that that is completely fake. I have fully subscribed to it. And I am so team the importance of art and I think maybe it's because I was like 18 or 19 and I was like, I'm not going to theater to be taught. I don't want to be a student when I'm doing this. I want to be entertained. I can't believe I ever thought that now because I'm just done a complete 180 on it. I remember there was a show at my school that I've now done in New York as well called Bent, which is a Holocaust play. And it focuses mainly on this Jewish gay concentration camp member who does unspeakably horrible things to not have a pink triangle, which meant you were gay, but to upgrade to a yellow star because Jews were treated better than gays in concentration camps. Like gays were the bottom of the totem pole. And I remember thinking, this is the perfect example of why theater is important. One, I think I was 20. I didn't even know that the pink triangle existed. I didn't know about the hierarchy in concentration camps. And I thought, even though there is a ton of art that talks about the Holocaust, this is a different side of it that I literally would not know this existed if it weren't for theater. And I'm like, this is why theater is important. This is why that's not flowery talk when people say that art is important. And I'm at the point now where, and it doesn't have to be that dark or deep or emotionally intense like Bent, but even if it's a comedy, it can have that effect. And I'm at the point now where if I see a piece of art and I go out for drinks after with friends and we're not talking about what we just saw, that's a red flag, that it needs to be sparking right. conversation in some way.
Yeah. I just had a conversation, with someone I met today, another artist, and we were talking about what it's like to be in a theater watching the same thing with people and how that's a very different art form than, a very different experience than, you know, watching even a film with people or listening to music on your phone by yourself or, you know, all these other ways that you can take in art. And there's something really profound and almost uncatchable in other circumstances about being in a theater and taking in a story altogether. And part of it, I think, and part of this is probably because I'm so obsessed right now with like how social media is ruining everything, that it's one truth that we all share, and we can disagree and we can fight about what we thought was good or bad about the play, or what character, you know, what the character was thinking or what they should have done. We can have all of those discussions, but it's centered around one truth. Whereas when we're taking in and consuming things now, it's very isolated. We're all in our own silo, consuming our own things at our own place, at our own pace, in our own kind of pattern and feed, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think I agree with you, and we are the same person, because I used to think too that people said that, like people were like, yeah, art's changing the world. But I was like, ah, oh, that's just because you get booked all the time.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's noble when you're working and you have your healthcare weeks with Equity, sure. But when you're not, it feels different. And then I think now, as I'm looking at it in a broader sense and claiming more of my path as something that I'm carving out, as opposed to waiting for something to happen, I do see, I can genuinely appreciate that there are some pieces that people make. And I'm not just saying that you have to make theater to have a real impact. I'm not saying that at all. Films can have an impact. Music absolutely has an impact. Poetry has an impact. Visual art, all of the photography, my God, yes. Like all of that has an impact. But I think the impact is because it is through the audience relationship with it, where we're seeing it, we're agreeing, the thing I'm seeing in front of my face is happening. And I think we've lost that in our everyday life. And art actually makes us more human and brings us back to that in a way that our phones and social media has disconnected us from that. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you? Do you agree?
Disagree? Yeah. I mean, the, David Mamet wrote this play called Oleana. I think that's what it's called.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one with the teacher student.
Am I getting this right? I think so, yeah.
And apparently the premise of it is this female is claiming that he was inappropriate with her, and he's saying that he wasn't. And it's sort of on paper that you see on stage unresolved. But he, on opening night, he handed out different programs for the men and the women. And for men, he handed them ones that in the play description was more favorable for the male teacher, and for the women it was more favorable for the female student. And he said that it was the only time that he had seen theater where people left with such radical different perceptions of what they had just seen, even though they just saw the exact same thing, because he had dictated an opinion to them before the show started.
Wow.
And that's such, I now don't know how to fully connect the dot to what you were talking about, but I feel like it's such a parallel of with social media, because we're, especially in this documentary you just talked about that's coming out, that we are being dictated to believe and think one thing that normally, besides this experiment that David Mamet did, we're all just sitting there getting the exact same information and the same experience.
Right. And the experience of being, you know, particularly with theater, you're doing it together. You're being an audience together. I don't know if you've ever been to like a play or maybe like a dress rehearsal or a tech or something where you're one of only a couple people in the audience, mm-hmm. you know, and you're like, yeah, you guys did it. Like, you know, you're just really engaged. Or maybe that's just me playing Jason. I'm like, you guys are amazing actors.
And you're laughing extra hard because you feel like you have to be the voice.
Yeah. I'm like, no one's around me. And I'm like, oh my God, did you just see that? That was so funny. And they're like, Ms. Romano, please leave the theater. I totally lost what I was saying. But we're doing the audience thing together. We're literally on the same team, you know. And in so many other places in our world, we're categorized away, like what David Mamet was doing. He was categorizing, right? He was creating. He was building a wall, shall we say? Mm-hmm. And when we do that, I think we miss out on some kind of like magical, I don't know, like mysterious, weird tendon or something, or ligament that kind of keeps us together. It keeps us as one, makes us realize that we are all one. I mean, now we're like, let's break out the mushrooms and like go there. But like, you know, like, I think that theater and live art of any kind, I should say, live art is really does this very elegantly, and we've lost it. And I'm obviously really interested in film, and I want to make more films, and I'm interested in film, and I wonder how to do that in film. And I think that might be my next journey, David.
Well, I have to say, so I've produced theater in the past, but I've never produced anything on film. And so I devoured the first three podcasts on here because I'm fascinated in the process of what you did for producing film. So please keep doing it, and I'll copy whatever you do.
Well, and same, I mean, like, and I didn't even get a chance to ask you, because I know you've made your own work and you produced your own work, and that's a whole thing. You're going to have to come back on, and we're going to talk about all of that stuff about creating your own work. But I want to finish off asking about this Hunter S. Thompson quote that I found. And I feel like for you, or for me, I think as an audience member watching you as an actor, it is so exciting because I do not know what you're going to do, but when you do it, it clicks in, and I'm like, of course that was it. Right. But I couldn't have known it. I couldn't have predicted it. I mean, I wrote and directed Screen Test, and then when we sat down for your monologue sections, every time you got me, like I had no idea. Like, we had rehearsed it a little bit. Actually, we didn't rehearse the monologues, did we?
No, I don't think we did.
Yeah, we didn't rehearse the monologues. Like, I think we did a little bit of direction while we were doing it, but we rehearsed some other, like, more group moments. But I was like, let's just cast the best actors in the world. And then we did. And let them do their thing, and let's go from there. And you, every time, I was truly on the edge of my seat watching you. And I think that there's something so... how do I want to say it? Just so unique. Unique is like too easy of a word, but I guess unique for an actor to be able to hold the audience in the palm of his or her hands like that. And so I found this Hunter S. Thompson quote, and he said, "The edge. There is no honest way to explain it, because the only people who really know where it is are the ones who have gone over." So I'm not going to totally like link why I just did that whole intro into that quote, but I guess I just want to ask you, have you reached your edge? However you would define that.
Edge in what way? In like peak potential, in like having a nervous breakdown? What do you think?
David, have you had a nervous breakdown? And at this point in 2020, I just assume all of us have. I think I mean edge, meaning like that kind of ephemeral space where anything can happen and you're creating possibility. And you have one foot on the ground of the here and now and one foot in some like magic somewhere.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have, which is good and bad, I think, because when I experience it in acting, it's the best thing in the world. And back to what we talked about what we're feeling versus what the audience is seeing, I don't even know, but I don't care, because it just feels like I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not worried about how I'm being perceived or the work that I'm doing. I'm just so dropped into the character, and it feels fantastic. But the problem with that is that doesn't happen all the time. And so then when I am working again, I feel like I'm constantly on a quest to get that again. And when I don't, it feels false and not as satisfying. But in terms of not just doing the work, but feeling sort of bliss or right where I'm supposed to be in my purpose, I feel like it's when I'm experiencing doing work that I'm really proud of, but it's something that I've created myself. Cause I think the, if you're producing something that it's, and it's your creation, it's the most artistically fulfilling thing you can do, because like Screen Test would not exist in the world if it weren't for you. And that's how I feel when I produce something. Like if I hadn't had the idea to do this, then like the world would have gone on and this wouldn't be out there. And even if it's, just theater and it's not something that can be distributed and is, you know, like Screen Test is a film, we can watch it forever, but like the experience that I had with it is there forever, and the memories I had with it. And I was reading some article, I'm jumping all over the place, but I was reading some article that was talking about how true happiness actually can only last for like 3 months from an experience. And I'm like, then you've never produced your own play, because that is like my baby forever. And thinking about it's such a community thing to bring in. Like I want to work with these actors and these designers and this director, and you bring in your favorite people. And, that is, I think when I'm doing that and I also get to act in it, that's my edge.
Yeah. And you know, I totally hear that. And there is something about, you know, how he's saying like the people who really know are the ones who've gone over, you know, this kind of tongue in cheek thing, like we can never really know our edge.
Yeah.
And I think there is such an edge about creating your own work, because as you said, it doesn't have to happen. And so the only person saying this has to happen is me. And there is a line that you step over when you say, I'm going to say go, that is freeing and scary and unknown and wild and the most naked you could ever be in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you are phenomenal in every way. I am so grateful to you for being in this film. I want to work with you again and again. I want to see your work in the world, your creative exploits, of which I know you have many up your sleeve when we get out of the hellhole of 2020. Mm-hmm. And maybe before, I don't know. I'm not trying to limit you, but you are you are truly someone that I feel like we need to remember your name, and I'm glad I know you.
I'm glad I know you. Thank you so much, Courtney. This was so fun.
Thanks.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode, the best thing that you could do is share it with someone. Either text it to a friend who might really enjoy this episode, or share on social media. You can tag me at Courtney Romano or at Queensbird Films. That always goes a long way. It means so much. You can also leave me a message, and I hope you do. You can do that by following the link in the show notes. Leave me a message with your thoughts on this episode or another one, some questions you want me to answer, or anything else you want me to know. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.